Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome back to Year in Review, as today we talk about non-targeted approach to non-small cell lung cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Ben Levy from the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Sibley Memorial in Washington, D.C. Today we're here to talk about non-targeted approaches for lung cancer. And as always, we will be discussing the use of non-approved agents and regimens. So check out the package inserts for various products for more information. So Dr. Levy put together a great talk reviewing some of the key papers over the past year. Here are some of the papers that we will be discussing, as well as some of Dr. Levy's own papers. Here's where we're heading. I'm going to just start out with a little introduction about my experience with the oncology boards, and then we'll dive into some of these papers and then end up, if we have time, hopefully talking about some of the research that Dr. Levy is doing. So, Ben, people always came up to me and said, well, your stuff really helps prepare for the boards, and I figured I ought to go figure it out. I was kind of grandfathered in. I didn't need to take the boards, but I took both the long one, and now I'm taking the every 3 month one. And I did that last weekend. You know, you do it every 3 months. And so I did the latest one this weekend. And of course, I'm not going to talk about any of the specific questions, but I just want to bring it up for a couple of reasons. One is I want to recommend that you take this every 3 months. This is a great exercise. They put a lot of work into this thing. Very, very well thought out. And, you know, you can look stuff up, you can use AI, whatever, but I recommend that you just sit down and take it, because as soon as you give an answer, they go through with you the correct answer, why it's correct, why the other answers aren't correct. And, you know, in about an hour, you really learn a lot. So this kind of inspired me. You know, there's so much great content nowadays. We spend most of our time talking about kind of what's happened in the last, you know, few months. And of course, the boards is a different story. You get into things that need to be vetted. It takes time. It usually runs a couple years behind. But this is really clinical scenarios and how you manage patients. But there are several things that, let's just say, I was inspired to bring up to you. They're not all related to non-targeted, but I think they're very interesting. So one thing is something, you know, we've done so many cases of docs in practice since the pandemic. I think we've presented like 5,000 cases, a lot of lung cancer, but not too many SVC syndrome. So I want to just give you an opportunity to chat a little bit, first of all, about your own experience with SVC syndrome. Is it usually small cell? Do you see non-small cell? And also, how do you make the decision between whether or not to start systemic therapy right away or do radiation therapy? What kind of complications do you observe with SVC syndrome? And is immunotherapy, you know, now that we have immunotherapy as part of first-line therapy, any complications of SVC syndrome that'll make you nervous about using an IO? So, Ben, what's your experience nowadays with SVC syndrome? How often do you see it?
Yeah, you know, I don't see it that often, and I'm not sure why. I think these are all good questions, though. I've seen it in the past. When I have seen it, I've seen it both with non-small cell and small cell. And I think that distinction is important because management may be predicated on histology. Obviously, if you have a patient sitting there that's, you know, got facial swelling and shortness of breath and a scan that suggests SVC syndrome, if they're non-small cell, I got to tell you, 9 times out of 10, I'm calling my radiation oncologist. And we are talking on the phone or chatting in my office about how to get this patient radiated quickly, because historically speaking, radiation has been sort of the cornerstone for treatment for SVC syndrome when it's non-small cell. I think with small cell, it's a little bit more nuanced and different. We have to remember that small cell is an exceptionally chemosensitive disease. And that's one scenario maybe when you see SVC syndrome, if it's small cell, where it may not be inappropriate. So it could be appropriate to start chemotherapy alone, given that the response rates to chemotherapy with small cell are anywhere from 70 to 80%. Third question about PD-L1, PD-L1 inhibitors, how to incorporate that in. You know, I would say for a small cell patient, I probably would hold off on the immunotherapy if I'm giving chemo, given that the response rate is really what we're looking at here, 70 to 80% with or without the immunotherapy. how to incorporate immunotherapy in the non-small cell setting with SVC is a little bit more difficult, because usually we are deferring to the radiation oncologist first on that. Would I potentially consolidate and start chemo IO after that? Certainly. But I think these are still some unanswered questions.
Okay, so here's another scenario. And again, we've been talking about this for years, but let's just say I got inspired to ask you about it by doing the boards this weekend. And it's the challenging situation of the patient with metastatic non-small cell. And you can tell me whether it matters, whether it's squamous or not. No actionable mutation, but the PD-1 is between 1 and 50%, particularly when you kind of get over 25%. And I was kind of wondering how you think that through. A patient says to you, wow, do I really need to take chemotherapy? I've heard of this immunotherapy. So great, I've got a PD-1 yeah. score, you know, whatever, 30%, et cetera. How you think this through? Are there people where you'll actually use a PD-1 alone? Do you think about how high it is, even if it's not 50%? So just kind of curious, would you ever like start an IO and kind of see how a patient does? Yeah. And then if they don't do too well, add in the chemo. We're going to talk later on about your work with cell-free DNA. Would that be something that would be helpful in a situation like this?
Yeah, the world's gotten complicated, much to the benefit of patients, given all the tools that we can leverage here. I think, you know, speaking of the boards, the board answer here generally for a patient with a PD-L1 less than 50 is usually chemotherapy with immunotherapy or chemotherapy with dual checkpoint blockade. Those are probably the two most common regimens that are used. Now, if they're adenocarcinoma, I would use a backbone of carboplatin pemetrexed. And if they're squamous, I would use a chemo backbone of usually carboplatin and a taxane. But you bring up a good point, and that is we need to remember that PD-L1 is a continuous variable, meaning that 40% is probably better than 30, and 30% is probably better than 20 when it comes to whether these patients are going to respond to immunotherapy. So it's not an uncommon scenario for me, and this is medicine as an art and, you know, not the science of it, where I may have a patient who's doesn't want chemotherapy, whose PD-L1 is 35% or 40%. I don't think it's unreasonable in that setting if a patient says, look, I get it, this is not where the data is, but I'd rather you spare me from the chemo. Let's just start with immunotherapy and see how I do. We can always layer in the chemotherapy after two cycles if it's not working. And again, medicine as an art, not a science here. The board answer is certainly chemo IO or chemo dual checkpoint blockade. I know we'll talk about this, but yes, there are plenty of times in my clinic where I have these conversations with a PD-L1 of 30 or 40%, older gentleman or older female, patient with comorbidities who doesn't want the chemotherapy. I don't think it's unreasonable to start that patient on single agent IO. It's not what I do for everybody. And then follow them carefully with scans and then make a decision whether you want to add the chemo later. How to track patients with ctDNA, this is the holy grail. I think that when we think about CAT scans, it really is a Polaroid picture. The ctDNA analysis is getting down more to maybe a digital photo, kind of a lousy analogy there. But, you know, the bottom line is there may be a role in the future for us tracking ctDNA and using that to decide whether patients will get chemotherapy or not. Start them on pembrolizumab or an immunotherapy, follow their ctDNA, and if it doesn't drop or it doesn't clear, maybe that's an opportunity then to add the chemotherapy.
Okay, so here's my other sort of inspiration to bring up to you. And again, it's really amazing how quickly things are moving, that if you're a couple years behind kind of what you missed. I always notice this with the targeted therapy because things are really moving fast there. It was kind of interesting that with RET, they didn't even bring up lorlatinib, but obviously in the last couple of years, that's come on board. But the other thing that's changed a lot in the last couple of years has been first-line therapy of EGFR mutant disease. Now, it just made me think a little bit about how the change in the approach now that we have three. Before it was just osimertinib. Now we have three options that are considered. And again, curious, for example, would you be much more likely to use a chemotherapy in a patient with brain mets? Would you ever, I don't know if you're an amivantanab, lazertinib type person. I'm not even sure what kind of CNS activity it has, but would that be a consideration? You know, you guys really led the way in the whole idea of using systemic therapy for brain mets. I see it in other cancers that people pick up on this. But also, it's changed a little bit. So how do you think it through nowadays that first-line therapy is different?
Yeah, I think it through carefully. I think every patient is going to have an individualized treatment approach. We have three approved options now for frontline EGFR patients with sensitizing mutations in 19 or 21, EGFR 19 and 21 mutations, osimertinib, chemo plus osimertinib, and amivantamab lazertinib. I would say if a patient is on the younger end, brain mets we know portend worse outcome. I tend to favor adding in the chemotherapy to osimertinib with a shared decision-making with the patient to understand that there are more toxicities than just the osimertinib alone. You know, right now, I'm still learning how to use amivantamab, lazertinib. We have a lot of clinical trial experience with the combination of these two drugs. There are some toxicity issues that we're still trying to wrestle with. That combination has exquisite activity in the brain, similar to chemo OC. So I would say that all three are options. They all have to be involved, all have to be integrated into sort of this shared decision-making. No right answer here. I would say my younger, fitter patients, I would use chemo OC. I think for my older patients, maybe osimertinib alone. Going to be hard for me to think about an amivantamab lazertinib patient right now. Probably a very young, fit, motivated patient.
All right, so speaking of EGFR mutated disease, something we're really not going to talk about much, but yesterday we saw this FDA approval of datopotamab deruxtecan, now first approval in lung cancer, EGFR mutant disease. We'll see what happens with non-squamous moving forward. Of course, in breast cancer, we already have dato approved in metastatic disease. And we'll get into that a little bit later when we talk about ADCs, but just to kind of put that on the radar for us to make sure we talk about. All right, so let's get into some of the papers. I'm going to let you take it from here.
Sure.
Starting out with immunotherapy with localized disease.
Yeah, a good place to start. I think we had some updates at ASCO this year on CheckMate 816. I think all of us are familiar with this study. Patients randomized who had 1B to 3A to receive neoadjuvant chemo IO versus neoadjuvant chemo, then followed by surgery. So we know now that the complete pathological response to neoadjuvant chemo IO is 25% versus only 2% in the chemo arm. But we had some nice updates at ASCO showing that there is a survival advantage with the strategy of chemo IO followed by surgery versus chemo alone followed by surgery. I don't think any of us are surprised, but it's good to know that this all tracks and that further updates the outcomes and the differences in outcomes hold. And this is a standard of care for patients. Looking at OS and lung cancer specific survival, not surprisingly here, we see curves here that diverge early and stay diverted and stay converged and creating, this was a new standard of care. This is what launched it all. This came from my colleague, Patrick Ford. This came out of Hopkins. We were thrilled to be a part of this initial effort. That was chapter one of a long story that's being written now with neoadjuvant chemo IO or perioperative IO for early stage lung cancer. The Aegean study was a very similar study. We've seen some updates recently from AACR and from World Lung. Again, patients with surgically resectable 2A to 3B randomized to either chemo durva in this case versus chemo alone. And on the back end, and unlike 816, patients got a year of durvalumab. And in the control arm, there was no immunotherapy either before or after surgery. And we saw similar trends here, complete pathological response with chemo IO versus chemo alone, improve major pathological responses with chemo IO versus chemo alone. And we've seen ticks on event-free survival here, kind of similar to what we're seeing with 816. We're seeing curves that diverge early and stay diverged. We're seeing improvements in event-free survival. This really solidifies the role of immunotherapy not only before surgery, but most likely after surgery. And we can certainly talk about that because it's a little bit controversial. If patients get chemo IO up front and they have a complete pathological response, do they need the IO on the back end? And if so, if they don't, who are the patients that need the IO on the back end? This is the updated analysis from Aegean that we have so far. Again, overall survival curves that look very similar to what we saw from 816. Keynote 671, yet another perioperative strategy and approach, platinum doublet with pembrolizumab versus platinum doublet alone, again, for surgically resectable 2A to 3B. And we saw the same sort of thing we saw with 816 and the same thing we saw with the G, and very similar outcomes here. We see complete pathological responses around 20% versus only 4% in the chemo arm. And we're seeing updated overall survivals. Once again, event-free survivals, overall survivals, similar and consistent with what we're seeing from 816, what we're seeing from Aegean. And then finally, CheckMate 77T. This was very similar to 816, but it added the nivolumab on the back end of surgery for a year, which 816 did not do. So this is a true perioperative Nevo trial. And once again, resectable 2A to 3B lung cancers randomized to chemo Nevo versus chemo. Again, surgery followed by Nevo in the experimental arm, and in the placebo, in the control arm, no IO on the back end. Once again, we're seeing these ticks and improvements in outcomes with this perioperative approach. This is not new to us anymore. We now have four or five studies that have shown this. So very, very exciting time for us to be in this field. The question always comes up, now that we have perioperative neoadjuvant chemo IO, do we go neoadjuvant chemo IO or do we go adjuvant? Like, the world in lung cancer has always been adjuvant. And then all of a sudden now we have these perioperative approaches. And I was fortunate enough to be a part of this review article that really just highlighted sort of the pros and cons of neoadjuvant versus adjuvant. And I would say the big thing, the big pro with neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy, number one is we know that patients are more likely to receive all four cycles of chemo neoadjuvantly versus adjuvantly. That is an advantage. But adding in the immunotherapy, of course, you're eliminating micrometastatic disease before the surgery. You get an early assessment of tumor response. And again, I talked about the higher adherence. Whereas adjuvant chemo immunotherapy, you can go right to surgery. And some of these patients want to go right to surgery, don't want to wait. I think right now, based on the data we have, we certainly have to pump the brakes given the benefit that we've seen in overall survival. This is a picture just showing the neoadjuvant biology and really the importance of delivering immunotherapy prior to surgery, where you're activating these tumor-specific T-cell responses that can rush into the tumor, and you're eliminating the ability for these patients for their tumors to metastasize to lymph nodes. So this just kind of hammers home the strategy in a pictorial, and these are sort of the practical implementation and the patient navigation. I'll just say this is a busy slide, but this does take some navigation. The ability for a patient to see a surgeon and that surgeon then say, hold on, we're going to refer you back to the medical oncologist. And oh, by the way, we need the EGFR and ALK before we implement the chemotherapy with the immunotherapy. That takes a village. And I think it's just so important that these cases are discussed in our tumor boards, that there's multidisciplinary care, that we're reaching out to the pathologist, we're reaching out to the surgeon to get a sense, and even our nurses to understand how this is going to happen. I think the big question still is, if a patient doesn't have a complete pathological response, do we want to give immunotherapy on the back end? I think most of us agree we probably should do that. We've just shifting gears here a little bit, still focusing on immunotherapy, but looking at immunotherapy more for all stages of lung cancer. This was a paper that we published out of Johns Hopkins looking at more than 11,000 lung cancer patients of all stages treated at Johns Hopkins. And you know, we always think that autoimmune diseases sort of, these patients don't do well and we can't give them immunotherapy. Well, one of the things that we did, again, looked at 11,000 patients, and roughly 4 to 5% of these patients had a rheumatological condition. And I think importantly, we characterized what they were. And I hope that this is representative of what we're seeing in the real world. But we see just a smattering of different autoimmune diseases for these patients that were treated at Johns Hopkins. And I think we learned a couple of things. One is these patients did just as well, if not better, than the patients without autoimmune diseases. So I think we always want to not treat these patients aggressively and not give them immunotherapy. And I would make the argument that we need to consider giving immunotherapy depending on what the autoimmune disease is. But these patients also had earlier stage diseases, which kind of runs counter to what we thought before. And then another huge Herculean effort that was recently done looking at immunotherapy for advanced stage disease, now not early, stepping away from the perioperative prospective studies and looking retrospectively at patients with advanced stage disease. As you can tell, there were lots of authors on this paper. It was a multi-institutional retrospective analysis. And the bottom line is this. If what we found was that if patients had co-altering KEAP1 or STK11 mutations, these are mutations that will come up on every single next generation sequencing report you do. There's a suggestion that patients don't do as well with the chemotherapy immunotherapy as they would if they didn't have a KEAP1 or STK11. So it seems like KEAP1 and STK11 create sort of this immunosuppressive environment that tells us that maybe chemo IO is not enough. The second clinical pearl from this study was we looked at the Poseidon data, which we'll talk about a little bit more in the program, but it basically showed that you can maybe get over the hump of the immunosuppression that this mutation carries by giving CTLA-4 with the PD-1 drug. So maybe this is an opportunity when you see this, and I don't think it's for all patients, maybe it's an opportunity to think that chemo IO may not do the trick here. Maybe you need to pepper in or add in CTLA-4 inhibition as well.
Before you go on, maybe you make a couple comments on the Pacific trial, and then we'll bring up a couple questions we're getting.
Yeah, I mean, getting to the Pacific trial, I just wanted to remind people, we talk a lot about neoadjuvant chemo IO and early stage disease and all these improved outcomes. But we need to remember that patients who aren't surgical candidates, who are still curable, who get chemo radiation followed by a year of durvalumab, the 5-year survival rate is 43%. That's bananas. That's something we've never really seen in lung cancer. And oftentimes, I think if a patient's not a surgical candidate, they're still in good hands because we can give chemo radiation followed by a year of immunotherapy. So it's a real exciting time.
And I know there was this other paper, yeah, looking at real-world outcomes. I always love to see this when it kind of supports what we've seen in the trials.
It does. Yeah, this was great. This was real-world outcomes through an expanded access program for durvalumab as consolidation post-concurrent chemo radiation for unresectable lung cancer. And like you said, Neil, I mean, it's great when the 5-year outcomes that we see in the real world are even maybe a little bit better than what they were in the trial. So that really sort of reinforces and recapitulates this idea that patients who get through concurrent chemo radiation should receive durvalumab on the back end. This is just showing you some of the outcomes based on subgroups from this real-world data. Not surprisingly, the non-squamous did a little bit better than the squames in this observational study. The PD-L1s greater than 1 did a little bit better than the less than 1s. The concurrent chemo radiation did a little bit better than the sequential. Bottom line, though, is that these patients did really, really well with immunotherapy post-concurrent chemo radiation.
So there are a million questions that come up related to the papers you just reviewed, but I'm sure people are going to go back and take a look at these slides and think about it. Just kind of curious, though, right now, do you yourself look at KEAP1 and STK11?
Yeah.
And are you more likely to use CTLA-4 yourself? I mean, I know it's not in the guidelines, right, but what do you do?
Well, I think it is an option. It's certainly chemo with dual checkpoint blockade with both Nivo Ipi plus chemo a la Checkmate 9LA is an approved regimen for non-small cell lung cancer. I would say that this is a nuanced discussion. When we see KEAP1 and STK11, there's no doubt based on the literature, it is consistent that this creates immunosuppressive environment, and patients that get chemo IO probably don't do as well as we think they would if they didn't have these alterations. I think the question here is, when you add the CTLA-4, yes, you may be able to improve outcomes, but that comes at a significant risk of more toxicity. And I think we have to ask the question, as I always ask the question, is the juice worth the squeeze? If I have some data to suggest that adding CTLA-4 may improve outcomes, is it worth the toxicity? And that's where I think I have to have these discussions with patients. I think it's really important to say adding a CTLA-4 may help. You just need to be aware that the rash, the diarrhea, the LFT abnormalities may be more than chemo IO.
All right, let's move on now and talk about metastatic non-small cell, but specifically related to immunotherapy, particularly updates on some of the key trials.
So the 9LA study is kind of what we were just talking about. You know, this was a study that we have updates on. This was a study looking at chemotherapy plus dual checkpoint blockade with both Nivo and Ipi versus chemo alone. Gosh, I would have loved if the control arm was chemo IO. Then we would be answering the question, does CTLA-4 added to chemo IO do anything versus chemo IO alone? It's not the study. But the study did show in an updated analysis, improved outcomes with dual checkpoint blockade with chemo versus chemo alone. Median survival times 15.8 versus 11 with a hazard ratio of 0.73. What's interesting, I get this question all the time. Outside of STK11 and outside of KEEP1, when would you use dual checkpoint blockade with chemo? And this is probably the most important slide to answer that question. The less than 1%, the PD-L1 less than 1%, there's a really robust survival advantage. Now, this was not powered to look at these subgroups, but that may be a group. You see a median overall survival time of 18 months, 17.2 months. That's pretty competitive. That's where I may think about using dual checkpoint blockade with chemo outside of the genetic alterations that we're looking at. I also think squamous cell may be the one. I think we talk about this a lot in meetings. Who is that patient that gets chemo, dual checkpoint blockade? I would say maybe an STK11 keep. Squamous and a PD-L1 less than one may be the way to go when you're thinking about this. The Poseidon study was very similar to CheckMate 9LA, a little bit different with the arms, but ask the question again, chemo, dual checkpoint blockade with durvalumab, tremelimumab versus platinum-based chemotherapy. There was also an arm that looked at chemo-durva, so just chemo-IO. So you do get a little hint here about what the addition of the CTLA-4 did to chemo IO regimen. This was an update from January 2025. If you look on the left here, again, when you're comparing both the chemo dual checkpoint blockade to chemo, this is figure A, you see a survival advantage. And when you compare chemo IO, you see a survival advantage when compared to chemo. When you begin to look at all three arms for both non-squamous and squamous, It does seem like this benefit was restricted only to the non-squamous, which runs counter to the message we heard from CheckMate 9LA, which is that squamous is the place to do the dual checkpoint blockade. It seemed like in this study, Poseidon didn't make a difference. Squamous didn't see, all three arms did about the same. So I think the jury's still out on exactly the right patient to choose for dual checkpoint blockade with chemo. This was a paper that I was happy to be a part of, and it's really the holy grail. And the spoiler alert from the results of this paper is that we didn't find what we were looking for, but we still tried to find. And you know, the bottom line is we're always looking at who are these patients that live 3 years on IO, and why are they living 3 years, whereas some patients who get IO live only 6 to 12 months or 1 to 2 years. So we tried to divide up two separate cohorts retrospectively and look at patients who've lived more than 3 years on IO and look at patients who haven't done that well and lived only a year, and tried to decide clinical and tumor and patient characteristics that would tell us differences. And these are sort of the things we tried to look at: the microbiome, the PD-L1 expression, the molecular profile, all of these things, the disease location, to try to tell us who are these patients who are living at 3 years. And we didn't find any real meaningful differences between these two groups, but nevertheless, these are the efforts we need to find. We don't know why some of these patients are living as long as they are in IO. Sure, a PD-L1 of 100% or a high TMB, no STK11 keep. Sure, those patients are more likely to live longer, but these outliers, the tail of the curve, who are these patients? What makes up their tumor? What makes up their microbiome? What makes up the host tissue that we can discern the differences between that and a patient who doesn't do well in immunotherapy?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by these exceptional responders. They're always great cases to hear about, but it's really amazing that you spent all this effort trying to figure out why, and maybe we still don't have the answer. One question about CTLA-4, you've mentioned it a couple of times. I'm curious in your clinical practice how using CTLA-4, whether it's Ipi or tremelimumab plays out clinically in terms of complications. Do you see any difference between the two in terms of toxicity? Yeah. What's the major issue with a patient with lung cancer?
Yeah, great question. I don't see much meaningful differences in outcomes or toxicities with either ipilimumab or tremelimumab. So I think those are relatively similar. I do think there is a different toxicity profile for a patient who gets chemo dual checkpoint blockade with either ipi/nivo or durva/tremi versus a patient who just gets chemo IO. And the things that I generally see in my clinic may be different than the paper toxicities that are on the trial that we see on the results section of the trial. I would say fatigue is one that we see more commonly, at least in my clinic, with dual checkpoint blockade versus immunotherapy alone or PD-1 or PD-L1 alone. I would say that rash and diarrhea tend to be more pronounced with dual checkpoint blockade. I would say LFT abnormalities are things that we need to look out for more that may be more frequent. And I guess if you were to compare the two papers, maybe they seem the same, but I can tell you in my experience, it's a different patient journey. And I think that's so important that these patients are on a journey now. They're not just getting one and done treatment. They're getting sequenced strategies and they're living years. And so you got to be so very mindful of the toxicities along the way and how to mitigate those.
So Hassan in the chat room says, what about the STRIDE regimen strategy in hepatocellular cancer where they give one dose of tremelimumab and that's it? Has that ever been looked at in lung cancer?
It hasn't, I don't think. This has been brought up. Can we get away with less? Do we need to integrate the CTLA-4 on every cycle, or can we drop it? Now, I think in some of the studies, they drop the ipilimumab after a while. I'd love to see just one or two doses to see if that primes the immune system enough so that you can kind of get out of the CTLA-4 inhibition. But these are the things that we still need to do, and we need to keep patients in mind. It has to be patient-centric here when we're talking about some of these toxicities.
So one more quick question. I really love that graphic where you looked at autoimmune diseases in patients with lung cancer. It really gives you a flavor of the frequency. I'm curious specifically, particularly related to rheumatoid arthritis, are there situations where you really won't use an IO or you really hold off on it? What are your criteria
Great
to hold
question.
It?
Great question. We are blessed here at Hopkins with a rheumatological division that has a significant interest in toxicities related to immunotherapy. And in fact, the leader of our medical oncology group who used to partner with them, Jerushka Nadu, is sort of led the way in sort of characterizing the degree of side effects from immunotherapy and how to get these patients through immunotherapy. I would say that in my mind, it is so important that I speak to the rheumatologist for every patient. I do this for every patient. No matter what the rheumatological condition is, I always speak to the rheumatologist who manage these patients. And I ask them, tell me what you think here. Do you think giving the immunotherapy is going to flare this? And if it flares, do you have the tools in your shed to sort of cool it off? This is, again, medicine as an art, not a science. I can't tell you how important that is. I do this for endocrinologists, too. With thyroid issues, I always call the endocrinologist, and I don't try to put them on the spot, but I tell them, tell me what you think here, because they're looking at the patient through a different prism than I'm looking at them. And so every patient has a different cutoff for me, but I always consult with them when I'm doing this.
Yeah, you mentioned Dr. Nadu. I love talking to her. She's like an encyclopedia when it comes to
this. Amazing.
It's really great.
What an incredible.
So let's chat a little bit about ADCs. We talked about the approval that just came out yesterday with Dato. Here are a couple of review articles that you were a part of that I just wanted the audience to know about. The slides are in the chat room if you want to pick that up and check out these papers. There's a lot going on, obviously, all throughout oncology with ADCs, but these are great papers on lung cancer and ADCs. Of course, we have T-DXd for HER2-positive disease, but now we have your first TROP2 target, now approved in lung cancer as of yesterday data. Yep. Can you talk about the TROPION-Lung01 study? Because the approval of EGFR was from the other TROPION study. It focused on patients with mutations, mainly EGFR.
Correct.
But this was a larger study. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, this was I think we're all disappointed in this study, although we're still gleaning insights from it. And the bottom line is this was a very clean study looking at patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, both adeno and squamous, who had had disease progression on chemo IO. If they had a target, they could have also gotten targeted therapy followed by chemotherapy. So it was either second line or third line, randomized to Dato-DXd 6 mg/kg versus docetaxel, which kind of still remains king, incredibly. 20 years, still in the second line. So we thought that this would be sort of a slam dunk home run, given some of the phase one data we looked at with Dato-DXd, the preclinical work that's been done, and the potential that it targets selectively tumor cells and selectively delivers a payload. Very clean study, randomized 1-to-1 in the second line. You know, unfortunately, in the intention to treat analysis, there was no benefit in progression free. There was a small benefit in progression-free survival, but no benefit in overall survival. However, when you parsed out histology, there was a benefit in overall survival for the non-squamous patient population. And so despite that, this did not move forward in the second line in an unenriched patient population. So I think we were a little disappointed in that. What's been interesting is this new biomarker, and I could spend 15 minutes on this biomarker alone. The bottom line is this biomarker is trying to measure cytoplasmic TROP2. The whole idea is the more cytoplasmic TROP2 you have, TROP2 protein in the cytoplasm, the more likely we feel that this payload is being internalized into the cytoplasm. So when you look, it's a tissue array, it's a tissue analysis, it's an artificial intelligence biomarker, a biomarker assisted by artificial intelligence, and the first in solid tumor oncology. So I don't think we should sneeze at this. It's still preliminary. The bottom line is, in the TROPION-Lung01 study, it did seem to tease out who did better with Dato-DXd versus if you were negative for the biomarker, but it didn't seem to tease out those who got docetaxel. So this was truly predictive of outcome for Dato-DXd, but not for docetaxel. I was fortunate enough to lead the phase 1b study. I presented this as an oral at ASCO just a couple of weeks ago. Question is, how does Dato-DXd do in the front line? You know, can it replace our beloved pemetrexed? Should we combine it with immunotherapy? Should we combine it with immunotherapy and chemotherapy? So this bottom line was looking at two separate sets of patients. Patients who were treatment naive, who got Dato-DXd plus immunotherapy, or that was called the doublet, or who got the triplet, which was Dato-DXd plus immunotherapy plus carboplatin. So again, steering away in one arm from carboplatin and pemetrexed, and steering away in the other completely from pemetrexed. And the doublet looked good. There was a median PFS of 11.2 months in the front line. These were 42 patients. This is a small data set. The triplet didn't look as good as the doublet, but that may have been due to the fact this is not a randomized study, and the triplet just happened to have more brain met patients and patients who were underdosed at a 4 mg/kg versus 6 mg/kg. I think the interesting part, the most interesting part of this study was this. When we took that biomarker, that new biomarker, novel biomarker, that's a artificial intelligence assisted biomarker, and we looked retrospectively at who did better in the front line, it seemed the patients who were biomarker positive, i.e. had more staining of their TROP2 in the cytoplasm of the cell, those patients did better than if you did not have a biomarker positive on tissue. Very complicated biomarker. I think we'll learn more about it in future studies. There's prospective analysis of this biomarker. The question here is, or maybe the point is, can a novel biomarker help sort out who's going to do well with this compound and who's not going to do well? And if you're negative, kind of like EGFR, maybe you don't use it. And if you're positive, maybe you use it. Does this go first line? Does this go second line? Really tough to tell. Very interesting times right now.
So, yeah, the idea of an ADC plus IO first-line metastatic disease is intriguing. We've seen that now with bladder cancer, with enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab, beat up cisplatinum combination. And now, as of ASCO, Sarah Tulaney from Dana-Farber presented first-line sacituzumab, another anti-trop ADC plus pembro, probably going to become the new first-line therapy for triple-negative breast cancer. So we'll see whether the same thing happens lung cancer. One question, though, getting back to Dato and this approval, I'm curious what your experience is with the Dato in terms of toxicity. We've heard about mucositis. We've heard about ophthalmic issues, ocular issues. Of course, everybody always brings up anything that second name of deruxtecan, ILD. I don't think they've seen that much. I know you've had some experience with Dato. I'm curious what your thoughts are. And, for example, how would you compare it to docetaxel or docetaxel ramucirumab in terms of quality of life for the patient?
Very different toxicities. I think the thing that you have to be watching out for and mindful of with Dato-DXd is the stomatitis. It is very common. In the study, at least, most of them are grade 1 or 2, but there are grade 3. And we need to do a better job mitigating that toxicity. I talked about the patient journey before and how important it is. When you have to answer that question, is the juice worth the squeeze? And, you know, stomatitis is one of those challenges where proactive steroid rinses, ice chips during the infusion may help mitigate that. And I think we'll get there. We're still learning, but a challenge. Docetaxel doesn't have that. I would say that the ocular issues are another thing we need to partner with our ophthalmologists for patients who come in and say, you know, my eyes are really dry. You know, that may be a keratitis or a corneal issue where we need to refer them to the ophthalmologist. ILD is not that of a challenge for this drug. I've seen it a few times, but it has been reported. When I think about the journey of a patient on Dato-DXd and I compare it to a journey of a patient on docetaxel, sort of summing it all up, and I'm biased, so I'll just throw that out there because I've led some of the studies with Dato-DXd, I think the journey is a lot better with Dato-DXd because there's you can dose reduce, you can get the patients through the stomatitis. I think we're desperate to use something other than docetaxel or docetaxel or ramucirumab. My experience with that combination is okay. I've treated lots of patients over the past 10 years with Dosi or Dosi-Ram. I think this is probably a little bit better. I think we know from the patient, from the TROPION-Lung01, that the non-squamous patients, there was an overall survival advantage with Dato-DXd. So if I have the drug and it was approved, which it's not, by the way, but if I had it on my shelf, I'd probably use it over docetaxel in the non-squamous patient population.
So I'm going to move on now and talk about an area that we saw a lot of excitement about. I think it was about a year and a half ago at the World Lung Meeting, bispecific antibodies in lung cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what the bispecifics are and what are some of the agents now in development?
Yeah, I think the bispecifics are just that. They tackle two different antigens on the cell surface of the cancer cell. They're usually IgG based. We think about a monoclonal antibody with the two FAB regions, and they attack to the same antigen. A bispecific is going to have two different FAB regions. That's one's going to attach to one antigen, and one's going to attach to another. And consistently, we're seeing over and over again recently by doing this, by abrogating or inhibiting different signaling pathways within the cancer at the same time with this bispecific approach, we're getting outcomes that I don't think we thought we would see. Probably the golden child of bispecifics right now in lung cancer is ivonescimab. It's a PD-1 VEGF bispecific. Who would have thought VEGF would be back in play in lung cancer? Yes, we had bevacizumab a long time ago. Yes, we still have ramucirumab in the second line. But if you would have shown me this molecule 5 years ago and say, look, it attacks VEGF and PD-1, I'd say, forget it. Well, that's why you play the game. That's why you run the trial. This was a frontline trial comparing ivonescimab versus pembrolizumab, which is the standard, in advanced stage patients that were treatment naive with a PD-L1 greater than 1%. Now, you could make the argument that pembrolizumab is probably not the ideal drug for PD-L1 1 to 49, but this was a global trial. It was actually exclusively done in China, where that is approved. And this is pretty compelling. I would have never thought this would be the case. By inhibiting both VEGF and PD-1, you can get an improvement in progression-free survival like this with a hazard ratio of 0.51. Again, pretty incredible to see these outcomes. And when we look at toxicities, there's not that much difference between, in my mind, when I look at this, between ivonescimab and pembrolizumab, yes, it hits VEGF. Maybe there's more proteinuria here, maybe a little bit more increase in LFTs. But overall, the word on the street is that this compound is not that much more toxic than pembrolizumab. You know, we did have a press release in April showing that there's an overall survival hazard ratio of 0.77, but that the data, the OS, is immature right now. So we'll have to see how this all plays out. But ivonescimab may become a new standard. Now, we need to run the trials in the U.S. and across the globe. That was exclusively done in China. But we'll see. Very, very exciting. Two other drugs that are worth mentioning that are bispecifics. One is volrustomig. The other is rilvegostomig. I hope I got those names pronounced right. Very new. Very new in a field. But again, one tackling PD-1 and CTLA-4. The other attacking PD-1 and TIGIT. And we're seeing very encouraging activity with both of these compounds. This is data looking at volrustomig plus chemotherapy in the first line, showing you can see these waterfall plots here. Again, this is a PD-1 CTLA-4 bispecific. Very encouraging data both in the non-squamous and in the squamous. This is first-line treatment. It's with chemotherapy. So we're going to see future studies with this. Toxicities are there. I would say rash, LFTs, thyroid, similar things that we see with immunotherapy are there. And I can tell you that the bispecific approach with a CTLA-4 and a PD-1 is much better tolerated than two separate drugs, PD-L1, CTLA-4, put together. And that's very, very encouraging. These are the ongoing studies. You're going to hear a lot more about this compound. This was featured at ASCO in terms of just kind of where to look for bispecifics. The other compound, rilvegostomig, PD-1 TIGIT. We think TIGIT's sort of like out of vogue, but maybe it's back in vogue. We'll see. And there's a whole program revolving around this drug. This was looking at this compound in patients that were immunotherapy naive with a PD-L1 greater than 1%. We're seeing response rates. You can see the waterfall plots that are here. And again, you're seeing toxicities, but you know, TIGIT has never been this pathway. When we abrogate it or inhibit it, that we get a lot of toxicities. So overall, very few grade 3 and no grade 4 or 5 treatment-related adverse events. There's a tremendous excitement around these bispecifics, and I'm very encouraged, and I never thought that I would be so encouraged. I thought you would need a payload. I thought you would need an ADC. You would need to attach a chemotherapy moiety to these monoclonal antibodies, whether they attach that monoclonal antibody attaches to the single antigen or as a bispecific. It just may be that a bispecific in and of itself is enough without the payload. Look at amivantamab. That is a bispecific, an EGFR MET-directed bispecific. Look at ivonescimab, a PD-1 VEGF bispecific. So there's a lot of interest coming out on bispecifics. I got to tell you that I'm starting to look beyond the payloads. Maybe we just get the right antigens targeted on the, you know, the right ones and go from there, because it seems like efficacy is not sacrificed. And it also seems like toxicity is a little bit better. So, yes, a lot of excitement with ADCs, but certainly we'll see what the bispecifics. A huge program revolving around this compound. You're going to see a lot of studies read out very, very soon. And then finally, acasunlimab. This is yet another bispecific that has promising data. This is looking at a bispecific that inhibits PD-1, but also inhibits another pathway that actually stimulates the T cell. So it's got both an inhibitory signaling and a proactive or trying to stimulate the immune system at the same time. And this compound's been looked at in combination with immunotherapy and as a single agent in patients who are pretreated, who are refractory to chemo IO. And we can see the combination of acasunlimab plus pembro. There's, you know, median overall survival time of 17 months, and this is launching. And this is the safety here. And again, we're seeing some of the same safety we see with other bispecifics, LFT abnormalities, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea. But most of these are grade 1 or grade 2 with very few grade 3. And this is the study, the ability study, makes a lot of sense to compare this to docetaxel, given the synergy that we saw in pretreated patients from the phase one. So a lot of excitement here with the bispecifics. It's going to be hard to keep up with them all. It's also going to be hard to know where they all fit in, but very, very exciting.
Yeah, your thought about do we need a chemotherapy payload is really a fascinating one. Obviously, we could avoid a lot of toxicity if we didn't have to use that type of payload. And I remember somebody in the past was talking to me about maybe in the future we would have ADCs with an immune payload. But yes. I guess in a way that's kind of like what you're talking about, which is a bispecific.
That's right. I mean, that's the question. Is the bispecific in and of itself enough to elicit an immune response, especially when you've got signaling that you know is relevant with harnessing the adaptive arm of the immune system? You've got the CTLA-4 and the PD-L1 drug on the antigens being locked in by the same molecule, or VEGF in PD-1, or TIGIT in PD-1. Maybe you achieve that with just one molecule without the payload, where you're able to elicit the response rates. Maybe it makes it easier to combine with chemotherapy versus an ADC. Maybe makes it easier to combine with targeted therapies. You know, this is where we've learned from amivantamab, you know, it can be combined with lazertinib, and maybe that's the way we have to go rather than using a payload or an ADC. As much as I love ADCs and participate in the science, I'm starting to rethink payload versus no payload with some of the efficacy results we're seeing.
So, yeah, when you mentioned who would have thought that VEGF was going to still be relevant, I immediately thought of John Hammock, who
That's
for
right.
many years has really been pushing that pathway. And I'm curious yeah. to know what he thinks about these new bispecifics. So the last thing I want to ask you about is some of your work, and particularly this paper in Nature Medicine. You know, I feel like almost every solid tumor program we do and some heme programs in the chat room, people always bring up cell-free DNA. A couple of people brought that up here already. And you've done some really interesting work in that. Can you talk a little bit about this paper and in general what you're looking at?
Yeah. Well, I think that this is a nice kind of round out to the hour and a huge effort on the part of mostly our translational scientists and Elsa Agnagnastu, who's leading sort of the ctDNA efforts across the globe. And the bottom line that we're trying to look at here is and ask the question is it reliable to track ctDNA in patients who are getting immunotherapy? And can we use that information to make treatment decisions? And do we need to wait for a scan? Can we use what we're seeing on a ctDNA longitudinal analysis? Now, this is not MRD, right? That's another way to look at it. That's post-surgery and you're cured, and then you track to see if something's coming up and then maybe make a decision. This is in the advanced stage setting where, you know, you're taking patients, and in this study, we took 50 patients, and we just basically treated them with pembrolizumab. These patients all had a PD-L1 greater than 1%, got pembrolizumab, and then tracked their ctDNA over time. And this was just sort of trying to get an understanding of what ctDNA does for patients on immunotherapy. And, you know, the bottom line that's really interesting, a couple things. One, this is not a bespoke ctDNA. This is just looking at the variants of interest for lung cancer. So we're not using tissue-informed. But we were able to really characterize four different patterns. Basically, what are the groups doing? And so there was certainly a group of patients who had complete elimination of their ctDNA after two cycles of treatment, which is pretty remarkable. Then there was a group that had complete elimination after three cycles. Then there was a group who basically had an 85% reduction. And then finally, there was a group that never dropped. Their ctDNA just never dropped when you gave the pembrolizumab. And what's really interesting here, and we report this out in different figures and in different iterations, and I'll just kind of give you the summary and then go through the slides briefly. But the bottom line was the response that patients had to ctDNA correlated with how they responded radiographically. So if you had a patient who had a drastic response or a dramatic response on the scan, there was a good chance that they had complete elimination of their ctDNA before that scan was even done. And so the question here is, can you use this information before a scan is done. And we're this is going to be rolled out into another study that we're now doing, which is essentially taking patients who are getting pembrolizumab, and if they don't clear their ctDNA after cycle 2 or cycle 3, we add in chemotherapy. Why wait for the scan? If we know you don't clear, why not do something early on? And maybe this is how we're going to use this in real time. And these are just multiple different graphics showing you that the drop in ctDNA clearance and even the depth of response correlates with resist radiographic response. So the deeper the drop in ctDNA, the more likely the tumor was to shrink and shrink more dramatically. So there's a nice correlation here. And, you know, we really look forward to you know, basically having this played out in real time in phase three. My hope is, Neil, that there comes a day very soon, maybe 2 years down the road, where if a patient's on immunotherapy or even targeted therapy, at 3 weeks or 6 weeks, I can do a simple blood test and say, hey, guess what? You cleared your ctDNA. This is, you're good. We don't need to do anything. Let's keep you on the drug. Maybe we stretch out your intervals of scans to 6 months rather than 3 months. Those patients who don't drop, however, that's where we say, look, maybe we need more frequent monitoring. Maybe we need to add in chemotherapy right away. So that's the take home from this paper. I feel passionate about the use of this. I think it's going to change the game for us in the next few years.
Maybe it's going to be on the boards in 10 years. Who knows? It'd be standard of care. But anyhow, yeah. I got to squeeze in one quick case from the chat room because Emily put this in twice. So I have a feeling this is actual a patient she's trying to make a decision on. I'm going to run by you real quick. Getting back to the durvalumab consolidation. 74-year-old woman, recurrent adenocarcinoma of the lung, stage 3 unresectable with KRAS G12C. Got chemo radiation therapy and is not, not a candidate for an IO because she had pneumonitis when on Pembro as adjuvant therapy. Interesting, we were talking about adjuvant IO. Yes. She got pneumonitis, so she doesn't want to give her Durva. So she wants to know, what about KRAS G12C inhibitor as consolidation?
Great question.
Or just the BERV?
I'll tell you, we've had this several times. Patients who've received prior IO in the adjuvant setting who've gotten pneumonitis don't want to pull the lever on consolidation Durva after chemo RADS because they've gotten radiation to the lung too. I'd probably observe in that setting. I wouldn't give a KRAS-directed G12C. Those drugs, right now, they're just not as good as we want them to be. We're so close with the KRAS G12C-directed therapies. But in that setting, if it's truly a contraindication to give immunotherapy, I'd probably just observe and watch closely.
So one final quick question. I think pretty much people have moved over with EGFR and ALK to using post-chemo radiation targeted therapy there. What other targeted therapy would you use a consolidation rather than Durva, ROS1, BRAF, et cetera?
Right. What a slippery slope. This is a tough one. I would say that every patient, every physician here may have a different answer. I would say for EGFR and ALK, post-concurrent chemo radiation, osimertinib and alectinib would probably be. Keep in mind, alectinib is not approved post-concurrent chemo radiation, but we use it based on the ALENA data. I would say for a ROS1 or a RET fusion, I'd probably, again, not approved, not FDA approved, I'd probably consider using a targeted therapy in that setting. I think outside of that, the jury's still out. The jury's out on everything other than EGFR, by the way. But I would try to get at least a ROS-directed therapy or a RET-directed therapy post-concurrent chemo radiation. When you start talking about BRAF V600E and MET-exon 14 skipping and HER2, yikes, it gets a little bit more challenging to make those decisions.
So, Ben, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You know, I always view Hopkins, my alma mater, as you know, I think that as sort of checkpoint central for the world. And I think some of the work that you're doing now just reinforces the fact there's so much incredible research going on at Johns Hopkins. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ben. Great job.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks.